case for today, 05-18-1026, Sands versus Whitnall School District. Arguing on behalf of Ms. Sands is Thomas A. Nelson. Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I am Thomas Nelson, and I am appearing today on behalf of Barbara Sands, the plaintiff, respondent, petitioner. This case comes before the court on an appeal from a non-final order. It arises out of a discovery dispute. The background of the case is that Barbara Sands was in charge of the gifted and talented education program at the Whitnall School District. According to the complaint in the case, her duties included monitoring and instructing teachers in the gifted and talented program, developing curricula for the program, developing and administering procedures to identify students for the program, and planning for and administering the budget of the program. She had employment contracts like other administrators and like other teachers in the district. The Whitnall School District decided not to renew her contract. It did so less than 4 months before her contract expired. And that presents the basis for the complaint that I filed on her behalf in circuit court. Wisconsin Statute Section 118.24, subpart 6, requires 4 months prior written notice for an administrator if a contract is to be non-renewed. The consequence if that written notice is not given with at least that much advance notice is that the prior contract is automatically extended for 2 years.
Counselor, was there any dispute that the notice was not given 4 months in advance of the termination?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, so the only issue really at the trial level was whether she was an administrator or not? Is that the issue?
Yes, Your Honor. That is the basis for the school district's defense in this case.
All right, thank you.
We started discovery, and I served interrogatories, and what I wanted to find out is what was said and who said it during the closed session that resulted in the decision to not renew Barbara Sands's contract. The school district objected to producing that information, and I told Mr. Schmeckpepper that I plan to take depositions of at least some of the members of the school board and the superintendent, who, although not a member of the board, also was present during these closed session meetings. The district refused to produce any of that information, asserting a privilege, an evidentiary privilege, based on the closed session exception to Wisconsin's open meetings law. The district did not base its objection to the discovery on relevance. The district did not seek any of the kinds of protection that a circuit judge can fashion to limit the way in which discovery is used or the people to whom it is disclosed. The district simply said it did not have to produce any of that information because there was a privilege, like the attorney-client privilege or the clergy person privilege. We went through a motion to compel. Circuit Judge Forenza in Milwaukee granted the motion and ordered the district to respond to the interrogatories asking about what happened at the closed session. There was a petition for review, which followed. Because there was a question about privilege, it was granted. Because there was a question about privilege, I didn't really object to the review, because we all understand that if...
Review by whom?
By the Court of Appeals.
You appealed, or somebody appealed the interlocutory...
The district.
...order. The district appealed. Okay, the interlocutory order relating to the motion to compel.
Right. Right.
Okay.
The circuit judge ordered the district to tell me, in response to my discovery demands, what had happened during that closed session about Dr. Sands or Barbara Sands and the decision not to renew her contract. Instead of producing the information, which would have made any issue about privilege moot, the district sought review from the Court of Appeals, which agreed to take this appeal from a non-final order.
I have a question for you. And as I understand your presentation of the case before us, the issue before the trial court as framed by the school district and the issue before the Court of Appeals as framed by the school district relates to Chapter 19 and privilege, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's your position. Suppose we were not dealing with a school district. Suppose we were dealing with the Smith Company, private company.
Yes.
They don't have to have open shareholder meetings, open director meetings, or open meetings relating to hiring or firing, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. Suppose you then, the same issue, that under their contract, there was a Ms. Sands' contract, the Smith Company, there was a four-month notice provision, and the issue is, was she administrator? What would Smith Company's defense be against the interrogatories or depositions?
Well, assuming that all the facts are the same, except we're...
And I'm going to ask that of opposing counsel.
Assuming
go ahead.
That we're dealing with a private sector company.
All right.
They wouldn't need a closed session exception to the open meetings law. As
I understand
you said, Justice
that,
Abraham,
but can you get that same information from a private company?
Yes, you could.
Why?
Because once we are in court, we're no longer just curious members of the public. Once we file a complaint in court, a civil action, we are entitled to seek discovery from the other side.
Well, you can't get maybe work product of a lawyer.
That's true. That's
might get not get privileged communication between the lawyer and the company.
That's true. There is a statutory privilege granting that kind of protection to attorney-client communications.
Well, why aren't you arguing that, and maybe you do and I missed it in all of the papers we've got, why aren't you arguing that you shouldn't have greater rights against the government than you have against a Smith Company? In fact, you should have greater rights against the government.
That's a good point, Justice Abrams.
Yeah, I thought so, too.
And I think that the what we're confronted with, what I was confronted with in this case, is a decision by the Court of Appeals that found implicit,
right,
not explicit, mm-hmm, but implicit, mm-hmm, in the closed session provisions of the open meetings law, which really doesn't talk about civil actions and it doesn't talk about discovery, it doesn't talk about the trial process at all. It talks about who from the public can just show up and watch.
It's a freedom of information statute.
It's a government in the sunshine kind of a statute. Yes, it is. Just like the open records law, which this court has had to look at a number of times. In fact, the Zellner case, you had us write letter briefs on when my petition for review was pending.
Maybe the assumption is that Smith Company couldn't win, therefore you had to find something, and you looked in open records and found implicit in that a privilege.
Well, I don't think, I mean, questions about the decision-making process in private sector companies come up all the time in employment disputes. The Equal Rights Division of the Department of Workforce Development deals with these issues all the time. And I deal with them in my practice under the state and the federal laws. When we're dealing with private sector companies, unless the lawyer is in the room getting information in order to give advice, whatever the managers, whatever the supervisors who are making the decision have to say about why they are making their decision is not something that can be screened from the discovery process.
Okay.
And I think the fundamental error that the Court of Appeals made in this case, on the narrowest grounds that would exist for reversing the Court of Appeals, is to confabulate the open meetings government in the sunshine rules, which talk about what the government must do with the public able to see what they're doing, and what a private party can do in a civil action based on a claim that her rights have been violated.
It seems to me, at first blush, and that maybe the information you're looking for has nothing to do with, is not relevant to whether she is or is not an administrator. But that issue wasn't decided or made an issue at the trial court, was it?
No, Your Honor. The first time I saw that issue raised is when I read the Court of Appeals decision. Okay. And I think it's a loser as an issue, too. The issue, the claim that I make is based on the question of whether Barbara Sands had the status of being an administrator. That's a term which is not defined in the statute that creates this right to 4 months of notice. The articulated reason for not renewing Barbara Sands's contract is performance-based. We know they talked about the decision not to renew her in closed session. Now, if they were talking about her performance, they're going to be talking about what she does. If they're talking about what she does suggests that all she ever does is teach students in one classroom, that's certainly relevant information about her status as an administrator. It wouldn't help me, but it would be relevant. If they talk about what she does, whether they're happy with her performance or not, with respect to planning budgets, planning curriculum, identifying students for the program, if those are the things they're not happy about, I think that that is relevant information on the question, the fundamental question in the circuit court case.
Did they need good cause to fire her?
I beg your pardon?
Did they need good cause to terminate her?
Well, not at the end of her contract term.
Okay.
They didn't fire her in the middle of a contract. They decided not to renew a contract.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So good cause is not an issue in this
no.
case.
All right. No.
So, counsel, can you tell me what it is? The timing is the issue. So what is it that you wanted to receive that would be relevant to the issue of the 4 months notice?
The relevance, and we're at the discovery stage, so the standard is easier because I don't have the information yet, but the relevance is to the question of whether or not she is an administrator. The timing issue that is the basis for the complaint depends on her having a position as a school administrator. The statute that we rely on gives administrators the benefit of 4 months advance notice, but not other professionals in the teaching business.
So you don't know if she's an administrator. You're bringing the claim, and you're hoping to find out during the course of discovery, depending on what they said in closed session, as to whether you can prove your claim?
Well, I have some information tending to say that she is an administrator. She was identified as an administrator on the school's webpage, as an example. But I'm at the beginning of discovery. I took the deposition of her immediate supervisor, and we're going off the record, so I'm trying to answer your question, but I mean, all I can say is that there was some evidence to support the claim, I would say. The defense is based on an assertion that she was not an administrator. There's no question that she didn't get 4 months advance written notice, but that only has legal consequences if she was an administrator.
Does she have a written contract?
She did, yes.
Is that in the record before us, or are we not looking at that?
I don't think it is in the record.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, the record in this case is on this discovery
issue. Yeah, it's very
issue.
Limited.
I yeah.
Do you think relevance is a question before this court?
It should not be. After the Court of Appeals decision, that's the one thing the three judges in the Court of Appeals could agree on, that I had not demonstrated relevance. I respectfully disagree with that conclusion. For the reasons I just gave, I think any discussion about her performance would shed light on what her duties were, and that is relevant to the question of her status as an administrator. More importantly, the issue was not raised as a basis for opposing the discovery, and it was not raised as a basis for reversing the circuit court at the appeal level. I don't think the district made a mistake when they didn't raise that, because I think the relevance is easily demonstrated at the discovery stage for the reasons that I've already given.
I'm sorry to be obtuse here, but could you say once more what it is that could have been said at the closed session that would have changed whether she was or was not an administrator?
I think what could have been said at the closed session, Justice Prosser, will shed light on what her duties were, because the district says they decided not to renew her for poor performance. So if they were talking about her performance, they're going to be talking about her performing the responsibilities of her position.
Why isn't whether she is an administrator almost a question of law?
It's going to be a question, a mixed question of fact and law, but we need to know what the facts are in a case like this, where there's evidence that she was an administrator and was treated as an administrator and was presented to the public as an administrator. She had a principal's license from the state, which is the administrator's license. The district says she was more like, some intermediate kind of a position holder between being an administrator and being a teacher. So there's an argument about whether she's an administrator. There is not a case gloss that I've been able to find on the statute I'm relying on dealing with the question about who is an administrator. So I don't know. We may be back on this case.
So if someone were fired and they just had an inkling, I think they fired me for discriminatory reasons or they decided not to renew my contract. I don't really have any basis for that, but I bet if I knew what they said in closed session, I could prove my case. That person ought to be able to bring a lawsuit, know what was said in closed session, and then decide whether or not they want to proceed further.
What that person needs to do first, Justice Ziegler, is think about the rules and the sanctions dealing with unsupported or frivolous claims. If you don't have any reason to think that there was something wrong with your decision, but you think maybe if you get things started, you'll be able to find out.
Most people would have some reason to think that, or some just, but they wouldn't have much maybe to substantiate that, or they just, it might be their impression and they want to find out. So that would work. I mean, anyone who had that impression could seek further discovery on that issue by closed session and then decide how to proceed.
If they have that impression and they have some evidence to support that impression, then if they're serious enough to go through the process of finding a lawyer and starting a lawsuit, then discovery is open to them. Even then, if an employer thinks that the plaintiff is just fishing or going too far afield, they can object to the potential relevance of any information sought and get a protective order for that information. If they're concerned about the collateral consequences of disclosing that sort of information, they can get a protective order to restrict its use.
And that's really what should have happened here, maybe, is what you're saying. They should have, instead of saying there's a privilege, said, this isn't relevant, we're seeking a protective order. Maybe, judge, look at this in camera, you'll see, too, that there's nothing here.
Well, I don't want to concede that any of those objections would have been valid, but they had those options. Short of saying we don't have to say anything about what happened, no matter how relevant and useful it is, because we claim this privilege based on an open meetings law, they could have made these more specific trial procedure-oriented kinds of objections in order to control the information that I was seeking. To limit it, maybe to prevent it, if they could make a clear showing that it's not even likely to lead to the discovery of relevant evidence. But they didn't do that. They didn't do that even in the alternative. They didn't say, we'd like to have this privilege, but just in case, it's also not relevant. And besides that, it's going to seriously embarrass third parties, and so it should be strictly limited in terms of who finds out about it and how it's used. All they had to rely on was the privilege. And my position here today is that that privilege does not exist, and it should not be created by this court.
Are you worried that perhaps in their meetings, descriptions were made of what she did that would assist you in ultimate at trial, but that when it came to trial, they would deny that that's what she did?
They would deny
That in the closed meetings, they might say she her job entailed A, B, and C, which you would say was administrative.
Yes.
But that when it ultimately came to trial, if you didn't have that evidence, they could say, well, it really wasn't A, B, and C.
That's not the real reason we had. Well, This trial is not going to be a just cause proceeding.
I understand that.
The question
is to whether she's
what kind of a job did she hold, not how well was she doing her job.
But her description of her job may be very different than the school district's description of her job.
Yes.
And I would assume that what you are trying to find out is if the school district had a very similar description of her job than the one you now claim.
Well, I'm trying to find out how the people who made the decision not to renew Dr. Sands, Barbara Sands's contract talked about what it is they wanted her to do before they made the decision. And that may or may not be identical with the way they're defending themselves now that they find themselves in court.
All right. That's what I was trying to get at. And I'm usually the rule is if somebody objects but doesn't state the right reason or doesn't state a reason with enough sufficiency, they lose their objection. On the other hand, the rule also is that the trial court will be sustained on any grounds that support the trial court. Here, the trial court ruled in your favor.
Yeah, I agree with that as a general proposition, Chief Justice. There has to be enough information in the record for the Court of Review to find a more solid legal basis for the ruling than the circuit court did.
Right. And you never got the chance to argue relevancy.
Nobody ever brought it up until I got the decision from the Court of Appeals.
Mm-hmm. And you think that we took this case for relevancy?
No.
What do you think we took the case for?
You
hope.
I think you took the case because you found the decision of the Court of Appeals to be inconsistent with the decisions about the open records law, including the Zellner decision, and on a more narrow ground, I think that the court took the case because the court did not want a law that was passed for a different reason, to regulate the access of the public to government decision-making, to take over the access of the courts, ultimately, to get all the evidence that's relevant to decide an issue before the courts. Where issue has been joined and where there is enough evidence for someone to go into court and say, based on what I know right now, I think my rights were violated and I'm entitled to a remedy.
What is the difference between Barbara Sands and Barbara Sands' request for this information and, say, mine, just walking in off the street and saying, I would like to know what went on in that meeting?
Barbara Sands has the option to use the rules of discovery, which are part of the rules of civil procedure. Her lawyer can issue subpoenas to people, hire a court reporter, swear them in, and ask them questions. I, on her behalf, can propose interrogatories to the other side, which, in the absence of a valid objection, have to be answered under oath. I can require the other side to produce documents.
Is this a discovery case, or is this a case under Chapter 19?
I say it's a discovery case. I think my worthy opponent will say that the two blend into each other more.
It relates to interrogatories and a threatened deposition.
Yes.
All right. And an actual case that's before an actual Wisconsin Supreme, actual circuit court.
Yes, where an actual order to compel discovery was granted by the trial judge.
So for your case, if Chapter 19 were totally repealed, you would still be here, would you not?
Well, I don't.
You might not
either
be
here. Either I'd be here or I'd have
my discovery.
You
wouldn't be here. It's a very hard.
You wouldn't be here because the Court of Appeals would have had nothing to rely on.
Because
Chapter 19 is gone.
Other than the relevant argument, which is there's In the alternative, I'll just take a moment to address this, if I may. The district argued that this court should use its common law powers, basically, to create a deliberative process privilege, even if the closed session provisions don't create one. And the Court of Appeals did not reach this issue because they found implicit in the closed session statute a privilege, an evidentiary privilege. The argument is that there ought to be a deliberative process privilege. And other branches of the government, including the federal government, does have something like that. I will just quickly say that it would be inconsistent with the jurisprudence of this court to do something like that from the bench. Wisconsin has been getting along fine without it. It has a long tradition of government in the open. There isn't any social science research or anything else that I know of to suggest that Wisconsin decision makers have somehow pulled their punches or made bad decisions because they thought that members of the public might be able to find out about them in the course of litigation. I see my time is up, so I'll...
I just have one other question. When I look at your appendix, and now I have to find it again, the only place, but maybe I'm wrong because I've only searched it with eye and not computer, that I find reference to relevancy is at page, your appendix 29. When opposing counsel says, whether she was an administrative employee was entitled to notice, which has nothing to do with what happened during the discussions. And so I mean, it's not enough to say it's discovery, because frankly, it's not relevant to anything. But secondly, I understand blah, blah, the way the court's going, and then it goes on for several pages prior to that and several pages after that. Is there any other discussion of relevancy here?
There is, Your Honor. At the bottom of petitioner's appendix, page 30, where the trial court is ruling, and carrying on to the following page, appendix page 31, she does sort of in passing address the relevance issue. And I think in summary, what she is saying is this is discovery. Maybe you'll find something, maybe you won't, but you satisfy the standard for discovery. And she'd already decided there's no privilege, and that's why she granted the motion to compel.
All right. So you think that, I don't exactly find it yet, but I will. What is the standard of review of a trial court's decision about relevancy?
Abuse of discretion, especially at the discovery stage.
Broader range of discovery than a trial?
Well, that's the statutory standard.
I said
the definition of what's discoverable is different, and Justice Kessler, in her concurring opinion in the Court of Appeals, cited to the discovery test for relevance. The majority of the court cited to the trial test for relevance.
All right, that's interesting. I hadn't noticed that, but I'll look at that again. Relevance is 90401 is relevant evidence. That's under the Kessler. That's what she cites.
Yes.
And the trial court in footnote 5 says 90412.
Yeah, I misspoke, Your Honor. It was Judge Kessler who cited to the discovery statute governing.
That's 80412A.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that the one you're talking
about?
Yes.
And it was the majority who cited to the trial evidence standard.
And there are two different standards, in your opinion.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeff Schmeckrepper. I represent the Whitnall School District. The issue that is actually before this court, in my opinion, and which is the only issue presented by this case, is whether or not the legislature's decision that a public body has the right to refuse to disclose its discussions in closed session will be respected and enforced. That is, in fact, what the Court of Appeals did. And it is, in fact, a decision that the legislature made.
Counsel, let me ask you about that. You say it's a decision the legislature made. There are a number of statutes that deal with confidential matter. yet we have not interpreted those statutes as creating an evidentiary privilege. And my understanding of 90501 is for purposes of privileges, they're to be narrowly construed, and they have to either be explicit or implicit within the meaning of the statute itself. So if we're not doing it with other statutes dealing with confidential matters, why is it implicit in this statute?
Because what I believe the court has done in the cases in which it has recognized a privilege is evaluate not whether there is some magic language in the statute, but rather whether creating a privilege is necessary to effectuate the purpose of the statute. What we have here is a statute which says, in general, meetings of public bodies are open to everyone. But in certain circumstances, you may hold a closed session. And there are no exceptions under which the content of the closed session must be disclosed. So the legislature has said that a public body, in certain defined instances, has the right to withhold disclosure of what it talks about in closed session, which are, by definition, pre-decisional discussions.
Isn't that under the open meetings law, and aren't we talking about litigation here? Aren't we mixing apples and oranges?
No, you're not, because the fundamental question, and some of the questions which were asked of Mr. Nelson direct us to this point, I guess. What the legislature has done, and I think when you read the language in the statutes, it's fairly clear. The legislature has said what's necessary for the proper administration of government for the benefit of everybody, the public. And they have defined that in the open meetings law. So what we now have is a situation where the legislature says good government, proper government, is effectuated by protecting closed session discussions. Is that outweighed by the rights of one person who says, I want to know what happened in the closed session? I would submit to you it's not. And there's a very simple test, I believe, which is consistent with how this court has construed statutes for decades, which is the legislature has never seen fit to create that exception. This is not the first time someone has been upset with a decision a public body made after they had a closed session. In fact, if you read through the exceptions to open meetings, with the possible exception of the last one, conferring with counsel, every one of those exceptions is going to lead to a decision which can result in litigation, every one of them. And yet the legislature has never seen it necessary or appropriate to say we're going to create an exception for when people are upset with what happens in litigation.
Let me ask the question maybe a slightly different fashion, because I understand you're arguing what I consider to be a negative here. Are there any cases where this court or the Court of Appeals has ever held that implicit within 1985 we have a privilege that should be recognized by this court? I mean, have we ever held that there's a privilege implicit within this statute?
No, and you have never held there is not. And I would suggest to you that, contrary to Mr. Nelson's arguments in the latter part of his argument, the standard understanding of this statute among lawyers who represent public bodies, among people who serve on public bodies, is that these discussions are confidential, they are privileged, they need not be disclosed under any circumstances.
Well, that's why you're here, right?
Well, I'm here because there is no case that says it is privileged, and there is no case that says it is not privileged.
Let me just make sure I have the framework of this case correct. We've got a lawsuit that's filed, and discovery was requested, didn't happen, motion to compel discovery granted. That implicates 804... 01 sub 2 scope of discovery. And that statute says on sub A, parties may obtain discovery regarding any matter not privileged which is relevant. So it is that discovery statute, the scope of discovery, that then with defense to discovery kicks us in to 19.85. Is that right?
Yes.
That's the posture of this case.
Yes. And I believe, to again come back to a point that was raised during questions from Mr. Nelson, I believe that this case is being presented in the proper analytical order, that is, privilege before relevance. If someone says, I want to know what your conversation with your lawyer was, I don't know of anyone who's ever suggested the thing you do is disclose the conversation and decide if it's relevant, and if it is, then decide if it's privileged. No. You say it's privilege. We're not even get to the question
of
relevance.
Well, he would say not the order of privilege and relevance. He would say the order is discovery, then privilege, then relevance. In other words, is this discoverable?
But my point is, if it's privilege, it's not discoverable, period. And that's the question you ask first, not is it relevant. If you find it's privilege, you never reach the question of relevance. If you find it's not privileged, then you deal with whether or not it's relevant.
And you agree relevance is different under 804.12a than under 904.01?
Absolutely.
Much broader under 804, because it says it can lead not to an issue, not only an issue in the complaint, but in defense, but that it might lead to other evidence that would be helpful. So it could be derivative and... Go on and on, right.
The test is obvious. Under the statute, it may lead to admissible evidence. It need not be admissible itself.
Right.
I believe this is a very tangential point, but I believe that the discussion of the importance of this evidence is at least based on the current record, somewhat overblown. I mean, Dr. Sands has been deposed. I deposed Dr. Sands. She's described her job. Her evaluator has been deposed and described her job and her job duties. She has a written job description. She has a contract, et cetera, et cetera. All of that is in the record.
Well, right. So what about if this was not the government, but it was Smith Company? Could you, and you were representing Smith Company, would you have to give over the information that, forgetting relevance for the moment?
Yeah, if it developed the way it did in this situation, that is, no counsel involved in the meeting,
right,
and no subsequent consultation with counsel, yes, I believe it would be discoverable.
So why do you think you got a better shot being the government and keeping things secret than being Smith Company?
First of all, I don't believe it's fair to characterize what the legislature has done is allowing government to keep something secret. Secondly, I believe it comes back to the point I made before. This statutory system is not designed to keep things secret. It is designed to promote better decision-making, better functioning of government. And it does so by saying in certain situations, people should be free to discuss openly where they want to end up on this issue. And they should do it without fear that they are subsequently going to read about it on the front page of the paper or be questioned about it in a deposition.
Yeah, but that's true of GM, too. That's true of Smith Company, too.
But they are not carrying out the duty, the business of the public. And that creates a difference. The legislature, I believe, could, if it wanted to, pass a statute and say private entities can meet and have a privilege to discuss our employees. They have not chosen to do so. That doesn't mean they can't. And this court has recognized this point. In the Pankhnen case, which is the case in which the criminal defendant wanted the sentencing judge's notes, this court, before it ever reached the public records issue, which was also part of the case, this court rejected that specifically because the court perceived that allowing a defendant access to a judge's pre-decisional notes was going to have a detrimental impact on the judge's ability to do his or her job and to reach a proper sentence. And you can find this in the U.S. Supreme Court. You can find it in the jurisprudence of other states, which we referred to in our brief.
Relating to judges?
Relating to government. Because the concept that people should be free to candidly and openly consider the options and hear each other out before they make a final decision is important for any proper decision, not just by judge or juries, because, of course, judges and juries have the benefit of making public decisions and never having to explain, other than what they publish, how they got to that point.
Counsel?
Yes.
Last term, we decided a case called Zellner.
Yes.
And in that particular case, there was a memorandum and a CD that were discussed and presented in closed session. And yet we ordered release. Doesn't that relate to the issue that's before this court?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Because, let me come at this from two perspectives. First of all, and the simplistic answer, but I believe the most obvious and correct answer, is it's a different set of statutes. 1935, which covers public records, has its own set of exceptions and includes a common law balancing test and all the rest. Now, Mr. Nelson and the amicus have argued that there's a conflict between open meetings and public records on the point that I'm arguing. I don't believe that's correct, but even if it is, even if you would find that to be true, it represents nothing more than the fact that the legislature reached a different conclusion when it considered oral discussions in closed session versus published documents, finished documents. And that's something they have the right to do. They are the ones who are charged with making those policy decisions. But I do not believe that there's a conflict between the public records law and the open meetings law at this point, because if you look at the definition of what is a record under the public records law, it does not include drafts, notes, or preliminary calculations, computations. So as you work, as the public body or the public employee works on that memo and, pardon the expression, plays with the language and decides exactly how they want to express what it is they have to say, exactly what their decision is going to be, none of that preparatory work needs to be produced. That is the functional equivalent of a closed session meeting in which the members of the public body, as I said before, discuss their options, where they want to come out, and then reconvene in open session and make their final decision. There is no question, there has never been a question in this case as to why Dr. Sands' contract was not reissued. It has been clear from the public session at which the board listened to her lawyer and then voted and recorded it in their minutes. And it has been clear since this litigation started.
Could I ask, Barbara Sands had alleged, this is pure hypothetical now, that the board discharged me because I am Hispanic, and they discussed that. I think they discussed that in their closed meeting. Is that still off limits?
It is. Excuse me.
How can that be good policy?
It involves the weighing of interests. If the president of Smith Company sits down with his outside counsel and says, I'm going to fire this employee because she's Hispanic, that's not right. But they can't do discovery on that because it's a privileged conversation. And the law has adopted the policy that protecting conversations with counsel outweighs the fact that it may be abused in a few instances. I believe the same is true here. The legislature has presumably concluded, because it has created no exceptions, that the interest of the public is best served by protecting what takes place in a closed session, even if it may be abused on occasion. But it comes back to the fact that we are not talking about something that happens with one person. We're talking about a body of people who, in my experience, work diligently to do what's right and to comply with the law and make the best decision they can. So can abuses happen and be shielded by this? Absolutely, they can. But again, if the legislature feels it's so important that individual litigants have a right to get into what happened in a closed session, the legislature has been free to create that exception since they created the statute and remain free
In a way, didn't they create that exception? I mean, your argument, the purpose, you say, of 1985 is for candid, to allow candid discussions, deliberative process. But in 1985, 1B, you have the ability of the employee to ask for an open evidentiary hearing. What does that do to your candid deliberative process?
It does not affect the candid deliberative process, in my judgment, because
it's open.
The hearing is open.
Yeah.
But the board could still choose to go into closed session to deliberate as to its decision. It has that express right under subsection 1, which is any time it's deliberating on a judicial or quasi-judicial hearing or trial, a board has a right to go into closed session. Basically, as I understand this subsection you've referred to, it only allows the employee to make sure that the evidence on which the decision can be based is made public. And in fact, there is and I can't bring the cite to mind, but there is a decision or an attorney general's opinion in which this point came up, because the board was meeting to consider termination, I believe, and the issue came up as to whether or not the employee could require it to be an open session. And I believe it's an attorney general's opinion, but they said no, because it's not a hearing.
Where do you find in the language, if at all, the purpose that you suggest is the legislative purpose?
The language is in the introductory sections of the open meeting law in sub 1 and sub 2, where the court says that in sub 1 that the public's entitled to fullest and most complete information as is compatible with the conduct of government business. And then sub 2, which says that meetings are to be open unless otherwise expressly provided by law. And again, as you review the exceptions, there are a small number of very specific issues on which the legislature has determined these closed sessions are appropriate and best serve the public's interest.
So you're hanging your hat on as is the language, as is compatible with public business or something like that. Is that it?
Yes. I think clearly the language indicates that the legislature has determined that there are limits to open government, to simply use that phrase. And those limits are determined by when the public's interest is best served by protecting what is taking place.
Who can invoke the privilege that you are espousing? Let us say there are seven people in the meeting, and two of them are really saying some just terrible things. Can five people release the information over the objection of the two?
I believe so. The privilege, as any privilege, would be held by the public body, and the public body can decide, as any privilege holder can, to waive the privilege or to assert the privilege. And in the situation you hypothesize, if the five board members conclude that this is an abuse which cannot be allowed to go on, they could vote to do two things. They could vote to disclose what happened in closed session. The other alternative is they could vote to meet in open session.
Could two people disclose what five had done?
I don't believe so. Because, again, it comes down to the
five could invoke the privilege.
Yes. Because the privilege is held not by, in my judgment, not by any individual. The privilege is held by the body as a whole, and only the body can decide.
Well, if there were seven, four could do it.
I'm sorry?
If there were seven, four could do it, under your theory.
Yes.
Counselor, does the school board classify positions such that some positions are classified by the board as administrative? Or does the school district classify them?
Yes. In fact, If I remember correctly, Dr. Sands' contract classifies her as a supervisor. But so there are administrators, supervisors, teachers, and then I think staff. Okay. But that is part of it.
We've had cases, and I can't recall them clearly enough, so they may be quite distinguishable, where a zoning board has to reach a decision. And would that be okay under closed?
I believe
this is a deliberative body trying to decide as whether you're going to get a permit or not.
Right.
But my recollection is minutes are kept. In fact, maybe even full transcription of the meeting, and that this court has reviewed those. And in fact, probably, if I remember right, either directed or at least strongly urged that hereafter zoning commissions or boards carefully state their reasoning, because what we did was we had a transcript of A said, B said, C said, A then said something different than she or he said before, and so on, and then ultimately a decision was made, but it was very hard to tell on what basis it was made, and we were going to review that. And we said, no, you got to give full reasons, and so we have a record to review. So we've reviewed records of deliberative bodies, is my point.
But I don't believe, and I think I know the case you're referring to, but I don't believe that that was something that took place in closed session. And I don't believe that anybody operating properly will make a decision in closed session, because you cannot under the open meeting.
Oh, but they're deliberating. Didn't the group have to come forth and say sooner or later she's not an administrator?
Pardon?
Did the school district come out and say that she's not an administrator? Was that their decision?
No, their decision was that her performance did not justify issuing a new contract.
The issue here is whether she was an administrator entitled to 4 months' notice.
That's the issue the plaintiffs have asserted, yes.
Is that a good issue?
It's an issue, yes.
Sure. Okay. But they haven't made up their mind, they haven't said yet whether she's an administrator?
The board,
right?
No.
They have not?
No.
Well, if she's an administrator and she wasn't given 4 months' notice, then she would be entitled to 2 additional years of employment, is that correct?
As most things in life, not quite that simple. Because there's also a provision in the statute which requires that an administrator who's going to have their contract renewed has to give, if I remember correctly, they have to give 3 months written notice of their intent to have their contract renewed. So we have many things to deal with as we get into this issue of how the statute functions if she was an administrator, which is itself undecided from a legal standpoint. And maybe to come back to your question and to hopefully be not leave a wrong impression, it's the district's position, and it's been the district's position, that she's not an administrator. That was not a decision made by the board, however. I mean,
well, that's right. I looked at the briefs. It's the district. And who makes the decision ultimately?
I believe that the proceeding to not renew her contract was based in part on advice they got from counsel, specifically whether or not the statute was applicable.
Who's they, and whose counsel are we talking about?
The district counsel. I'm talking about the school board.
All right. The board, so that's why the district is named? Is that it, rather than the board? Is the right party named here?
The right party is named.
Yeah, and
the board is technically the right party. I had advised Mr. Nelson before the litigation started that if he would simply name the school district and not the individual board members, we would not raise that as a defect in parties, just to avoid having them named and substitute as they come on and off the board and the rest of it. So there's no defect in parties. But
then the district has made a decision that she's not an administrator.
No, the district was advised that the statute does not apply. No, and so they acted on that advice.
Well, does the district, they classify her as a supervisor while they classify others as an administrator.
Correct.
So to some degree, they've already made their own factual determination about what she is. And the question that is being argued about is their factual determination the same as the legal definition, whatever that may be, of administrator under the statute. Is that kind of where you are?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, what I'm wrestling with is the district, the board, everybody there had an understanding of what her position was and what it was not. And I don't want to mislead anybody on that. At the same, I don't want to leave the impression that there was or had to be some deliberation by the board and making a decision as to whether or not she's an administrator or not an administrator, because they obviously couldn't. It's not their decision. It is ultimately the court's decision.
But when you say that she was or was not, though, you're talking about whether the board's classification as an administrator falls within the statute's definition of administrator, right?
Correct. Correct.
Is it true, then, the board made its determination based upon counsel's advice?
No, the board made its own determination to not issue a new contract.
But, I mean, on the status of her being an administrator, was that based upon counsel's advice? I might have missed something in what you said.
I am trying to recall that because it was not me.
Well, counsel's advice would be privileged anyway, so yeah. It's not really much help to us.
Not to get into too much detail, but Dr. Sands was represented by different counsel when this was going on. And that counsel had raised the question of the statute. And my recollection is the board was advised by the district's regular counsel that the statute was not applicable. And so the board proceeded to do its evaluation and make its decision. Dr. Sands then retained Mr. Nelson, and we've moved on from there.
Would it be a correct statement to say that at the discovery stage, that what is discoverable is that which is not privileged, which is relevant or may lead to relevant evidence? Is that a correct statement?
If it's not privileged, yes.
It's discoverable if it's relevant or may lead to relevant evidence.
Correct. I think the statute uses the term admissible evidence, but it's...
That's exactly why I asked the question the way that I did. Is it your understanding that there are cases or that's one and the same, may lead to admissible evidence, is the same thing or consistent with may lead to relevant evidence?
I don't believe so, because admissibility is not only going to be relevance, but also materiality.
That's right. And other things. So that's why I asked the question the way that I did. Is your answer still the same? My question was, is it discoverable, assuming that it's not privileged, if it's relevant or may lead to relevant evidence? Is it discoverable?
Technically, my response is it's not discoverable. It's only discoverable if it may lead to the discovery of admissible evidence, meaning it's both.
The reason I asked, because right back here, the way back of my mind, it seems to me that at times it has been referred to as the way that I said. It's relevant or may lead to relevant evidence. It's been referred to that way in cases and in the vernacular. If you go to some seminar, they're going to talk that way. And I'm wondering if the words of the statute have been interpreted to mean relevant or may lead to relevant evidence.
From my experience arguing these kinds of motions in circuit courts, I think that's exactly the way the statute is being interpreted.
Yeah, but the last sentence says it's not ground for objection that the information sought will be inadmissible at the trial if the information sought appears reasonably calculated to lead the discovery of admissible evidence.
Yes. Right.
And my question is whether or not that language is interpreted to mean relevant or lead to relevant evidence, if you know.
I believe it is. I mean, in the give and take in the courtroom, I believe that's the way it's discussed by lawyers and by judges.
Whether admissible or not.
Pardon?
Whether admissible or not.
No, I think it is discussed for discovery purposes in the broader sense of relevance, because judges, and understandably, I guess, don't want to get into a discussion of whether evidence might be admissible or prospective evidence might be admissible when they are months, if not years, away from a trial. I could give you a long argument about why, even if what Mr. Nelson has hypothesized took place, did take place, it's not admissible because it's not material in view of everything else, but that's an argument for a different day.
Counselor, are we looking in this case at a question of law or a question of fact or a mixed question of law and fact that's opposing counsel referred to earlier for the statutory administer that has to be term that has to be determined?
I think it is. From my view, it would be a strict question of law, but I mean, like every question, it's got factual components in it, but the fundamental issue is, what does the statute mean when it says administering? And once you define that, then you can take the facts of your specific case and say it matches or it doesn't.
You apply or don't, right.
So to that extent, there are facts involved. Otherwise, I believe it's a pure legal question.
Thank you.
But what's the issue before our court? Isn't that a pure legal question?
It is a pure legal question. And I would like to, I see my time is up. I would like to close with a comment that touches on something that understandably has not been the principal focus of the arguments here today, but I believe has to be the principal focus of your decision. And that is, this decision doesn't just affect the Whitnall School Board, the Whitnall School District, and Dr. Sands. This decision is going to affect how every public body in this state operates from this point forward. And that's why I think it's important to not make the issues of this particular case the driving force in how this case is decided. I believe experience, this court's decision in Pankin shows the recognition that having the ability to, prior to making a decision, freely discuss, candidly discuss all of the options and work on reaching the best decision you can make serves the public's interest.
You know, I find that a very compelling argument, and it's bothered me since I started this case and throughout the discussion. But I thought public officers are protected by immunity, judicial and quasi-judicial, legislative, quasi-legislative decisions, they're immune.
From
liability.
That may be. But
so why is this so protective of them? Since they're going to be immune from liability, they can say what they want. They can. I mean, that's the whole point about a governmental immunity, that they can be free to act. Why do they also need protection of silence?
Because, as this court recognized in Pankin, as the U.S. Supreme Court has expressly recognized, as all these other states have recognized, as I believe the Wisconsin legislature has recognized, fear of liability is not the only thing that drives people. I mean, the federal courts have recognized that if someone is concerned that something they say is going to show up on the front page of the newspaper tomorrow, they're probably not going to say it.
Well, they better not be in government.
There is a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, I know.
And the higher
we'll
you
talk
go,
about that.
The higher you go in government, the easier it is to say that to somebody. But when we're talking about someone who's coming in at 7 o'clock at night after working all day to spend a couple of hours at a school board meeting to try to keep their school board operating, that's not as easy to say to them. It's not as easy to say you should open yourself up to criticism from your neighbors and everybody else because you want to take an unpopular position because you think it's right.
Chief, if I might. Counsel, your argument, as I understand it, stems, and you made the point here this afternoon, from 1981, sub 1 and sub 2. And I think you have, as I read that statute, you have to read the whole statute together to discern its meaning, since we're not supposed to be creating judicial privileges here, and that it has to be inherent, implicit, or explicit in the statute. What do you do with sub 3? Sub 3, as I understand it, under 1981 Declaration of Policy, is the only section that I see that provides specifically for secrecy in government, and only when the public welfare requires it, and only for the two houses of the legislature. I don't see secrecy in sub 2, and I don't see secrecy in sub 1. What I see in those two sections is whether or not there are exceptions that relate back to 1985 as to whether or not a meeting can be held in closed session. I don't see the secrecy that is implicit in your argument explicitly stated in the statute in this context.
I'm losing my voice here. I disagree for the reasons I alluded to before, but I think the conclusion is inescapable given the structure of the statute, and specifically that the legislature has said that in these certain circumstances you can meet in closed session. Even the amicus brief from the media in this case conceded that the legislature, by creating the closed session exceptions, intended to shield those discussions from the public. I don't think there's any fair reading of the statute that can come to another conclusion. I think the issue this court has to confront comes back to a point you made, which is there something in the statute which says, under these circumstances, the public body's right to not disclose those is outweighed and is destroyed? Or will the legislature's decision not to create such an exception be implemented and the Court of Appeals affirmed? Because I believe the Court of Appeals analysis is correct. And I don't believe there's any proper construction of the statute that can arrive at a different conclusion. I believe in order to arrive at a different conclusion, you would have to create an exception to the statute that doesn't exist in the statute. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Nelson, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. If the legislature had intended to do what the school district says it implicitly did by creating a closed session exception, if it really wanted to create a privilege, we would find that privilege in Chapter 905 along with all the other privileges. It's not there, and there's a reason why it's not there. This court has already found in the Oshkosh Northwestern case that motions and roll call votes created while a governmental entity is in closed session need to be produced in response to open records requests. In Zellner, documents specifically created for consideration by another school board had to be produced, and the fact that they were created for closed session was not found to be a basis for resisting their disclosure just to the public, not even in the context of a lawsuit. It's like saying if a lawyer writes a letter, I didn't know that there was any legal advice about who was an administrator and who was not in this case. But it's as if saying with respect to the attorney-client privilege that if the lawyer meets with a client and says something to them, that's privileged. But if the lawyer gives the client an opinion letter, that letter may or may not be discoverable later on. There just isn't a privilege here. And the way this court has dealt with records requests is pretty much decided that the policy considerations that the district is offering in support of a privilege do not carry the day here. The scope of the privilege, I think it was Justice Prosser who asked some questions about, you know, what if a majority of the members on the school district or some governmental body want to assert the privilege? The answer is then their privilege exists. Well, what if a minority of the members on the body want to assert the privilege? Well, the answer is if they're outvoted, then they don't have a privilege. If that's the way it works, everything that Mr. Schmeckpepper said so eloquently about, you know, the solid citizen who shows up at 7 o'clock at night to make the tough decisions, it's not going to work in this case. If the tough controversial decisions need to be disclosed if the majority wants them to be disclosed. There's in any situation where the deliberative body needs to have a vigorous discussion before they make their decision, the people participating in it are not going to be able to assume that they're protected by this privilege, if they needed that kind of protection. I think that people who undertake public service, we all owe them a debt of gratitude, but they know what they're getting into in a free society. And in Wisconsin, they know that government conducts its business with very limited exceptions before the public, much less much less can they assume that what they do, if there is a valid claim that passes the kind of scrutiny required to file a lawsuit, can be satisfied that what they did deprived someone of their rights. The Department of Justice filed a friend of the court brief in this case on behalf of the petitioner, and I would like to conclude, unless there are questions from the court, with something.
I have one thing that's bugging me.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out how, and I'm going back a little bit to the relevance question, which at first I thought had absolutely no relevance to the question before us, but now I'm a little bit troubled. And if you look at, and you don't have to get this out because you probably know the statute much better than I, but if you look at 118.24 sub 1, it says a school board may employ a school district administrator, a business manager, and school principals and assistants to such persons. Okay, and your argument, if I understand it, is that your client is a school district administrator, because by virtue of that caption, she can fit into sub 6 of 118.24 and require 4 months' notice before the contract is non-renewed. If you know what her duties were, you know what her contract says, it seems to me that nothing people can say on a board can be relevant to what the legislature meant by a school district administrator in the statute. So I can understand you have to apply the law to the facts, but we're trying to decide what the statute means, because the school board's already classified your client as a supervisor, not an administrator.
Well,
I'm having trouble understanding what they could possibly say that will inform our decision about what the statute means.
Well, first of all, the definition that you read, Justice Rogan-Sack, I think, as you said, it refers to assistance to those individuals as well as people with those titles.
It doesn't say assistants get 4 months' notice, however.
I think it does, the way
was that before?
People defined
no,
in subpart one.
I'm just trying to figure out what they could say that would be relevant. That's how it's before
or may lead to relevant.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Well, except for enumerating those people by using that language, there is no definition.
Okay. So you think you can still set up a construct by facts that you will learn from what was said there that were more fully informed whether she was an administrator or not?
Well, one fact I have for my construct already is that this very school district identified her as an administrator on their webpage.
Okay.
But I want to have all the facts before I have to make that argument.
All right.
And
okay.
That's what I'm trying to do today.
Right. Thank you.
So as far as the policy issues go,
you've got just a couple of minutes to complete your argument.
Okay.
You're on red light already.
I'll just refer the court very quickly to the Department of Justice's brief, which says that the privilege sought by the school district is nothing less than a license for governmental bodies to deny individuals and organizations who sue them a full and fair opportunity to litigate their claims. This court ought not to countenance such a denial of due process.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, both Mr. Nelson and Mr. Schmeckpepper, on your arguments today of privilege and open meetings in a very different context than we've heard before. That concludes our hearing on 05AP1026, Barbara Sands versus Whitnall School District. Court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45, when it will hear another three cases. The court will meet in closed session at 3:20 p.m.